You've been listening to Viewpoint with Chuck Crismeyer. Viewpoint is supported by the faithful gifts of our listeners. Let me urge you to become a partner with Chuck as a voice to the church declaring vision for the nation. Join us again next time on Viewpoint as we confront the issues of America's heart and home.
The views expressed on this program are those of the hosts and guests and are not necessarily those of IR and its advertisers or affiliates.
This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and for this hour, they're going to be the views of Jerry Smith, who's a writer. We carry a couple of his books. One is Weather Warfare, and the other is on HARP, the High Altitude of Rural Research Project, the super secret government project up there in Alaska, with similar projects throughout the world that heat up the ionosphere and can change weather. And of course, one of the things we're doing right now is we're in California experiencing terrible, terrible storms and terrible weather. And really, the weather is changing all throughout America, all throughout the world. In some places there are drastic water shortages, in other places there is flooding. And the question is, why are these things happening? Is this an act of God? Or is there a means of changing and altering weather patterns? And why would anybody want to do that? Or maybe there is another agenda out there. And if it is being done, would the people who are doing it admit what was going on? Well, with us is a good friend, Jerry Smith, and we've had him on before talking about weather warfare. But of course, there are a number of things that can be done to alter the weather, and they've known how to do it for many years. They just don't want you to know what they know. And so you go back to 1970 in the book Between Two Ages by Zbigniew Brzezinski, who is one of the really crafters of modern day policy. He had written a book in 1970, and David Rockefeller read it and hired Zbigniew Brzezinski, and he's worked for the internationalists, the globalists, ever since then. But in 1970, he talked about how in the future they were going to be able to create storms and droughts and all sorts of new terrible diseases to disable people. And, well, good evening, Jerry. How are you?
Well, hi, Dr. Stan. Good to be with you.
Well, it's good.
I was just looking at a quote from Mr. Zbigniew out of Between Two Ages, and he wrote, "New weapons have been developed, but not only have new weapons been developed, but some of the basic concepts of geography and strategy have been fundamentally altered. Space and weather control have replaced Suez and Gibraltar as key elements of strategy."
Yeah, but of course, we can't let the common people out there realize what we're up to, because Zbigniew Brzezinski and David Rockefeller and the globalists are, well, they're our superiors. As David Rockefeller told a friend of mine, some men are born to rule, but most men are born to be ruled. And so we do have a ruling aristocracy in America. They control both political parties and make mockery of the electoral process. And not only that, but they know how to alter the weather. We're going to be back in just a moment with Jerry as we explore what he has learned. He's done a great deal of research. I think his book is the finest one on weather modification. We have it right here at Radio Liberty. Well, Jerry, you pick up the story and tell us about weather warfare.
All right. Well, I begin the book with a quote from Secretary of Defense William S. Cohen. In 1997, Cohen was speaking at a conference on terrorism, weapons of mass destruction, U.S. strategy, in his official capacity as the head of the DOD, Department of Defense. So you can take this as official U.S. policy or official U.S. understanding. And in 1997, the U.S. government believed, and I quote, "Others are engaging even in an eco type of terrorism whereby they can alter the climate, set off earthquakes, volcanoes remotely through the use of electromagnetic waves. It's real, and that's the reason why we have to intensify our efforts." Now, I believe if the department, if the Secretary of Defense says something like that, we should pay attention. And my book is a 400-page analysis of whether or not he was speaking truth. And I concluded that he was right, that those are indeed operational conditions today.
But, of course, it sounds so absurd, Jerry, when you tell people, they look at you, their eyes glaze over. Oh, it couldn't be true, because if it was true, why would read about it in the newspaper or Rush Limbaugh would tell us? But the reality is, we aren't really getting the truth, are we?
Oh, absolutely not. And the reason it's not in the U.S. papers probably goes back to the upshot of what happened during the Vietnam War. During the Vietnam War, the United States got caught with its fingers in the cookie jar, if you will. The United States military was using weather as a weapon during the Vietnam War. Operation Popeye was ongoing for some 8 years. It was an attempt to extend the monsoon season in Southeast Asia by using cloud seeding over the Ho Chi Minh Trail in hopes of turning the Viet Cong resupply route into a hopeless quagmire of mud. The Pentagon admitted that the program had been ongoing for some 8 years. They expended 47,000 units of cloud seeding materials over four countries, two of which in violation of international law, North and South Vietnam and neutral Laos and Cambodia, at a total expenditure of about $21.6 million. When that came out, when the congressional investigation discovered that, that led to an international treaty banning weather as a weapon. That treaty is called the Convention on the Prohibition of Military or Any Other Hostile Use of Environmental Modification Techniques, also known as the ENMOD Convention.
And when was that passed?
That was signed into law in 1978.
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Jerry Smith, talking about his book on weather warfare, pointing out that during the Vietnam War, under Operation Popeye for some 8 years, the United States military were seeding clouds and modifying the weather, Sydney, along the Ho Chi Minh Trail, so there would be such a quagmire that it would be difficult to have trucks carrying the weapons that were being brought in at Haiphong, which, incidentally, we weren't allowed to bomb or try to do anything to stop them coming in. But at least the military, since they wanted to try to win the war, they didn't understand they weren't there to win, but they really thought that what they could do, if they could modify the weather along the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And so for 8 years, they did that, and then eventually the information came out and during congressional investigations. And in 1978, the United States signed a treaty saying that with other countries, saying it was illegal to modify the weather for warfare programs. Of course, treaties are like bread crusts. They're made to be broken, and I suspect that they've used weather modification many times, but we can't let the American people understand they have the ability to modify the weather anywhere at any time they want to. So pick up the story there, Jerry.
Well, you had commented that that Americans don't seem to know about it because the American media doesn't tell them about it. And my point was that prior to our signing the ENMOD Treaty in 1978, the United States federal government was spending between $40 and $140 million a year on developing weather modification technology and had over 700 degreed scientists working in this. After we signed the treaty, the federal budget went to zero, and those jobs went away. And we would Uncle Sam wants us to believe that he said, "Oh, can't do that anymore," and just stop doing it. When in fact, it was converted to civilian operation. It went to civilian contractors. One of the principal civilian contractors today is Weather Modification Incorporated in Fargo, North Dakota. And oddly enough, in 2005, one of the senior scientists there went on the Art Bell show and outed himself as having been one of the senior scientists on Operation Popeye that had done the cloud seeding over the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Now, after the U.S. signed the treaty, not only did the federal budget go away, but oddly enough, all the news stories went away. Prior to that, there were all these magazine and newspaper articles about the future of weather control and how we would soon have hurricanes buttoned up and nailed down and completely docile. And after we signed this treaty, the news stories just stopped. So most people never heard about Weather Modification Incorporated or the dozens of other companies that are doing it across America today.
And I think it's so important for our listeners out there, if you're skeptical, why, once you, if you have a computer, you go up on the computer and you Google in weather modification. And you'll find all sorts of companies that will offer for a price to modify the weather here in America and any place in the world. And the Russians do the same thing. So,
the Chinese even more so. In 2005, Business Week magazine, a nice mainstream, straight-ahead publication, reported that in China, the Chinese federal government was spending $40 million a year and had 35,000 people employed full-time in weather management. You may remember last year, the Chinese government announced that they guaranteed perfect weather for the Olympics. How can they do that? Well, they had 35,000 people working on it round the clock.
And of course, the average person got to say that couldn't be true. But if you don't think it's true, you go up on the internet and just Google in weather modification. These companies for what do they charge? Do you have any idea what they charge to modify the weather?
I don't. I've never looked at the rate sheets for
all right.
This.
All right, fine. But we have a 4-tape set, and on this one of the interviews with a woman who's, Sydney looked into this company called Weather Modification, and Sydney, they have modified the weather, taken all the moisture out of the air over Montana, so that they could build the moisture up in the snowpack, so there'd be more water to ship to Los Angeles. But what happens to the people who are east of Montana, who depend upon that water for? And then we find out that there are tremendous droughts in the east today, and my goodness, some of the nuclear plants are having to shut down because there's no water in the lakes or the rivers to cool down the uranium there, the center where they actually generate the electricity.
Yeah, exactly. And you brought up one of the key questions in this. This question goes back the first scientific weather modification in the United States took place in the 1890s, and there have been legal battles running for 130 years now. If I make it rain where I am, and you're downwind of me, and it doesn't rain where you are, did I steal your rain?
Yeah, absolutely, but of course, they let them do it.
Right. Right this moment, as you mentioned, Weather Modification Incorporated is working for the ski resorts in Sun Valley, Idaho.
Right.
And they're increasing the snowpack in Idaho and desiccating the air going east from there.
Right. So anyway, the technology is there, but even more interesting is hurricanes. Can they create hurricanes? Can they subside hurricanes? Can they steer hurricanes?
Absolutely. Scientific American, the backbone of America's scientific literature community, had a cover story in April of 2004 in which another civilian scientist working in one of these civilian contractor think tanks released his findings that he now was absolutely dead convinced he knew how to steer a hurricane. At the same time, and actually a decade earlier, you may have heard of the Russian company Late Technologies. In the 1996-97, there were forest fires burning out of control in Malaysia and Indonesia. And Late Technologies went to the Malaysians and said, hey, you know, we can create a hurricane on demand and blow out your forest fires. And the Malaysians went for it. They ponied up a never-admitted amount of money. The Russians whipped up their big wind and blew out the forest fires. They also flattened hundreds of villages and left thousands of people homeless. But that's collateral damage.
Well, I think that people in America really know so little of what's going on in the world. And this is one of the great tragedies because of the degree of control over the media, the average person has no idea of the things that that Jerry is talking about tonight. So do you think that this is being used? Certainly we find these tremendous droughts over in Australia, which of course caused a marked decrease in the amount of wheat which is available in the world. And certainly they were having droughts many times in Africa where entire crops are being wiped out. And then other areas, certainly there was massive flooding in Zimbabwe and Zambia and Mozambique within the last two or three weeks. And people were dying, 30 or 40 people died in the floods, the flash floods that streamed down the rivers, and many times the children trying to cross the rivers were swept away to their death. Do you think that they are actually using this, or are they just letting nature take its course?
It's almost impossible to know. One of the things I point out is that Mother Nature gives great credible deniability.
Right, and so basically, since it's all top secret and we can't let the common people know what's going on, why, of course, it is a military secret. Nobody in government would dare come forward. If they did, they'd be sent to prison.
Well, it's not just that. There's also, we live in an incredibly litigious age. A classic example of this, and the what shows how the government normally responds to this, is the first attempt to steer a hurricane, Project Cirrus, which was 1949. And Project Cirrus had scientists from General Electric and the U.S. Navy flew out to a hurricane that was safely well out to sea in the Atlantic and cloud seeded it. And shortly after the cloud seeding material was put into the hurricane did a 90-degree turn and came on shore near Savannah, left 1,400 people homeless and killed a couple of people. The Navy's response was to immediately slap secret, put it all under national security and classify all the paperwork. General Electric got their lawyers to round up the scientists and told them to shut up and sit down. And from that point forward, none of the scientists who worked on the project were ever allowed to say anything in public without first going through the lawyers. And the head of the project was absolutely convinced that he had succeeded in steering a hurricane. It went the wrong way, but he was convinced that he'd figured out how to steer a hurricane. But never was it published in the open press. That did end up, a decade later, when the Navy finally declassified the papers, it ended up in the papers where it gave his opinion, but the way the Navy got around that is they trotted out a peer review panel to go over the paperwork as they released it, and the peer review panel said, "Oh no! They just put 180 pounds of dry ice into a hurricane. That's not going to do anything. Don't be silly. This didn't do anything. There's no reason to sue the Navy or General Electric over this."
And so we can't let the public know when they played their little games.
Exactly, because if they screw up, we might sue them. We might putting them in jail is one thing. Suing them is something else entirely.
But of course, the other thing is, if the average American knew what some of the people in the government were doing, and I'm talking about the evil people, not the good people, but there are evil people there, why we would lose confidence. We have a government report, we call it the Rockefeller Committee report, that came out in 1994 from the Veterans Administration over the name of Senator Jay Rockefeller, that told how the military has experimented on hundreds of thousands of American military without their consent or knowledge. Experiment on them, endangered their lives. Go ahead, Jerry.
Oh, I have an extensive analysis of that report in my book, Heart, the Ultimate Weapon of the Conspiracy.
Well, we carry that book as well, and we'll want our people to know we do carry the report. You should read it. You should understand what's really going on, because Rush Limbaugh's not going to tell you. Well, go right ahead, Jerry.
All right. Where would you like to take it from here?
Well, you tell me, because you know the subject so much better than I am. Certainly, we signed this treaty that back in 1978. Have other countries been developing the weather warfare? You mentioned that both China and Russia seem to have the ability to modify the weather as well.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that. I have been talking about this for a long time now, and one of the things that I find really interesting is the legislation, is the legal angle on this stuff, and very few radio hosts want to go into the legal. I suspect it's because it's, you know, sort of dry, and it's not the sexy stuff that, you know, like earthquakes on demand. But I find it absolutely amazing that at several levels that the U.S. and the USSR jointly sponsored a treaty they really didn't want and managed to get a few nations to get on board with it, and then the treaty is largely forgotten. Only 70 nations have signed the treaty, and according to the CIA, there are more than 270 nations. I believe there are 272 nations who are members of the UN, and the CIA says there's another 50 countries that aren't members of the UN. And out of the 300 some on this planet, only 70 have actually joined this thing. This treaty is supposed to have a review every 5 years. It's been around since 1978, and they've only had one review of it. And when they did the review was 5 years late, and only half the treaty signatories actually even bothered to send somebody to the review meeting. The majority of the governments on this planet don't have a clue, and those who do have a clue, most of them are really not interested in this treaty, because that means they can't play with these toys.
All right, fine. Well, of course, I believe there are probably close to 200 governments in the world, but that's not an important point. Where does HARP fit into this high altitude of rural research project?
High frequency,
right.
Right, the high altitude, that was Gerald Bohl's super gun.
All right.
The HARP is the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program.
All right.
It is a field of antennas on the ground in southeastern Alaska, so linked together as to work as one giant antenna. And it is today the world's largest radio broadcasting station, but it's not designed to broadcast for human ears. It's designed to inject 3.6 million watts of radio frequency energy into a spot at the top of the atmosphere. To give you an idea of what that means, the largest legal AM radio station in the U.S. is 50,000 watts. HARP is 72,000 50,000-watt radio stations injecting their entire output into a space about 12 miles across by about 2.5 miles deep by about 90 miles up at the very top of the atmosphere in a region called the ionosphere. Now, this heats the ionosphere by several thousand degrees, so much so that it blows apart the molecules of the atmosphere. And when the molecules are blown apart, they give off a packet of energy, which includes a scream of EOF, extremely low-frequency radio waves which penetrate deep into the earth and deep into the sea. And the U.S. Navy has been using this to communicate with deeply submerged submarines for about 15 years
now. Hold that thought there, Jerry. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Jerry Smith, and we're talking about HARP. And Jerry has a book on HARP, which we do carry. And that's the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Project. Is that right?
That is correct.
All right, fine. And basically it generates a phenomenal amount of electric power, and it actually centralizes it in an area in the ionosphere, maybe 12 miles or so across, and begins to break apart the molecules. I mean, you're talking about, what are we talking about, really millions of volts, is it, or megahertz, or what?
3.6 million watts of radio frequency energy.
Okay, fine. And, of course, centralized in one small area. And then, of course, they can then bounce that off the ionosphere to into the ground, into the sea. And they apparently the Navy uses this to contact submarines anywhere in the world. So go ahead with your story there. What is HARP for? Does this have any weather modification implications or defense implications? Because it's all top secret. Everything has to be speculation. But Jerry studied this.
Well, remember,
we don't want the communists to learn what we're doing. Of course,
HARP,
we're going ahead.
HARP is a very odd creature in that it, again, is a case of civilian contractors. It is both secret and not secret at the same time. The military says, well, it's not a military project. There's nothing secret. There's nothing classified about HARP. But there are ways to keep secrets without having to slap top secret on the top of the page. One thing is you simply don't publish it. Most of the most important documents about HARP have been simply registered as unpublished, and so only a handful of people can get them because they get Xeroxed and passed around at conferences. And the other thing is that the HARP website, which supposedly is completely open to the public and is supposed to tell us everything we want to know about HARP, hasn't been updated in 5 years. So they are telling us absolutely nothing, but they're telling us. And the question of whether it has weather applications is at very much part of the core of the debate of what HARP is and whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. A major science magazine, and for the moment I cannot remember which science magazine, in 2002 noted that in the year 2000 there was a dogleg in the jet stream immediately over the HARP site that resulted in a swarm of unseasonal tornadoes in Florida.
And, of course, the thing is that everything would suggest that they can alter the jet stream with this. Would that be a fair appraisal?
Absolutely. HARP is apparently based on a suite of patents, and I list the first patent of the 12 in full in my book, HARP, and list all 12 of the patents, but without their, so you can look them up in the back of Weather Warfare. These patents are clearly for a ground-based Star Wars weapon system. When you heat the ionosphere the way HARP does, blowing the molecules of the atmosphere apart, that converts the atmosphere into a plasma, which is an electrically charged gas, and it goes out into space. And it keeps going out into space until it runs into something to stop it, like a passing spy satellite, an incoming ICBM, or the Earth's magnetic field. The plasma gets trapped between the Earth's magnetic field and spreads out, forming a barrier, a shield, of electrically charged particles that will disrupt or destroy anything electrical, like a satellite coming through it. Now,
How about a missile coming through it?
Exactly. Now, the HARP people say, oh, no, that's not us. We have nothing to do with that. Those patents are not ours. That's for something 40 miles on a side, and we're only 1,000 feet on a side. But the proof that they are it is in who has gotten the contract to build the thing. The patents were originally taken out by APTI, which was originally ARCO Power Technologies Incorporated, but the ARCO in the name gave away too many secrets, so they changed the name to Advanced Power Technologies Incorporated. They got the contract to build HARP initially because it's built on these patents. It's a unique, one-of-a-kind thing. The APTI was bought by E-Systems, a major defense contractor. E-Systems then got the contract. E-Systems was then bought by Raytheon, one of the world's largest contractors. Raytheon then got the contract. Raytheon then spun off E-Systems to BAE Systems, the former British Aerospace, and they got the contract.
I see. Well, of course, a lot of these are military. Certainly Raytheon's a military contractor.
Absolutely. BAE Systems is one of the world's largest military contractors.
So that sort of gives us an idea that maybe they're not being forthcoming with this. I mean, it is totally illogical that our government, with all, you know, the money that it has not built an anti-ballistic missile system. We have 6 missiles stationed in Alaska, which are supposed to guard us against some 3,000 or 4,000 Russian missiles. Are we really supposed to believe our leaders are that gullible and foolish? Well, this is Dr. Stan, and my remarks suggest that we're not being told about the Defense for America. Certainly, we are working, and we probably already have operational, a laser defense against incoming anti-ballistic missiles. What part HAARP will play in this, we really don't know. And, of course, they claim that there's nothing secret there, but they're certainly not telling us. They don't want us to know what's going on. But believe me, the Russians know. In fact, today, America, despite the fact we are having to borrow $2.5 billion a day just to meet our everyday expenses, a lot of that money being borrowed from other countries, why we are still funneling money into Russia under one or another pretense. Why would we be doing that when they've got over $440 billion in reserves? Well, lots of unanswered questions. So, Jerry, as far as this is concerned, what do you think that HAARP is being used for at the present time, or do we have any idea other than experimentally just to see how it works?
Well, there is what it's officially being used for, what it's unofficially being used for, and what the people who, like myself, who have been trying to connect the dots think it's being used for. Officially, it's being used for very little. HAARP was in the news of sorts last weekend. HAARP did a test in which they bounced their radio signal off the moon and asked ham radio operators around the world if they could hear it. This should have alerted some people that something was up, in that you may remember the old CIA spy ships, the USS Pueblo and the Liberty. The Pueblo was captured by the North Koreans, and the Liberty was almost sank by the Israelis. They both used the technique, a brand new then in the 70s technique, bouncing radio waves off the moon so they could signal back directly to Langley, CIA headquarters. But it was a one-way thing. They didn't have a receiver. They only had sending equipment. HAARP may be working out some of the bugs out of that system for a next generation of moon-bound secret spy stuff, but we really don't know. We do know that it has been used to communicate with deeply submerged submarines. The Navy admits that. The HAARP website admits that.
Well, some people have said that it can be used to pick up minerals in the ground. Is there any truth to that?
Well, yes, no. HAARP was originally funded to do something very much like that. It was originally funded to do something called earth-penetrating tomography, which is a brand-new science that it did not exist before the 1980s.
I'm going to have to interrupt you there, Jerry, because we're going to bring our stations back on board. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Jerry Smith. His book is Weather Warfare and HAARP. Is that the ultimate weapon?
Right. The first book is HAARP, the ultimate weapon of the conspiracy. And the new book that just came out is Weather Warfare, the Military's Plan to Draft Mother Nature.
All right, fine. Well, anyway, before we go on, Jerry, I want you to get your website up, because I know you have some other books, and although we do carry the book on HAARP and Weather Warfare, I want to give you an opportunity to get out your information as well.
Right. My other book is Secrets of the Holy Lance, the Spear of Destiny in History and Legend. My website, I'm Jerry E. Smith, Jerry with a J. And my website is jerryesmith.com, jerryesmith.com.
jerryesmith.com, okay.
And you'll find a great deal of information on the site. I have a section for each book that includes a basic overview of what the book is, the table of contents, reviews of the book, articles about the book, breaking news stories about that subject. And there's also an archive of articles I've written, a book of my poetry, biographical material, and some other cool things.
All right. Now, Jerry was saying that we know that HARP is being used to bounce signals off the moon to communicate with various parts of the world. But we also suspect that it has been used for other purposes. But, of course, the government will not tell the American people, even though, of course, we're being charged and we're paying for this, but you common people really are incapable of understanding what the elite are doing. Why are they developing these bizarre types of weapons? And, of course, we said earlier, HARP certainly would appear to have the capacity to alter the jet stream. And in the past, it's been pointed out that the jet stream going over this region has been altered. And, of course, this then has a profound impact upon weather across America. What other purposes do you think HARP is being used for?
Well, again, the curious thing, one of the very, very curious things, is that HARP was originally funded to do something called earth-penetrating tomography, which is a brand-new science. HARP is a type of device called ionospheric heater, and there are about 20 ionospheric heaters scattered around the planet, but only HARP uses a unique patented ability to sequencing the firing of the antennas within the antenna field to focus the energy coming out of it. All the rest of them are just a whole bunch of antennas, and the energy goes away and dissipates, but it does manage to heat, they do manage to heat the ionosphere somewhat. And another ionospheric heater in Alaska called High Pass, operated by the UCLA, succeeded in heating the ionosphere enough to break down the molecules to create this scream of ELF, extremely low frequency radio waves, and use that, because it goes deep into the earth, they used it to find and map out an old tunnel system outside of Fairbanks, Alaska. With that, they went to the U.S. Congress and got the Senate military appropriations committee to fund HARP to do that on a grand scale. And HARP was originally funded to bathe the world in ELF so that they could locate and monitor enemy underground bases for the manufacture and launch of weapons of mass destruction. Now, the wacky thing is now, almost 20 years later, there's not a single word anywhere in HARP literature that they have ever done this. This leads me to ask the question, is HARP thumbing its nose at the U.S. Congress, or have they done it and done it so well they don't want anybody else in the world to know how good they are at it, and are just deliberately staying mum on the subject?
Well, we know that the communists in Russia have extensive underground cities, even and command headquarters, and they're really prepared, of course, when the nuclear war comes, to be able to protect the large segments of their population. And we've heard, so we understand that there other countries really are pretty good at building tunnels. And I suspect we are as well, but of course we would never want to let the American people know that. The only thing, of course, we do know is that they are preparing for nuclear war. They're preparing underground places for the elite to go to be protected in case of a chemical, biological, or neurological warfare, but they've totally discouraged any defense for the average American.
Now, on the weather angle of this,
all right,
what I suspect is going on with HARP is that HARP is being used to tweak the jet stream so as to, during hurricane season, build in a high-pressure dome over the southeastern United States. Now, my evidence for this is that the HARP was completed in 2006. You remember the 2005 hurricane season was the worst ever. That's Rita and Katrina, Wanda. That was the largest number of named hurricanes ever, the largest number of Category 4 and 5 hurricanes ever making landfall in the U.S. in a single season. The following year, HARP is raced into completion. HARP was scheduled to be completed in 2007, and they finished it right around Thanksgiving Day 2005. by 2006 hurricane season, HARP is at full broadcast capacity and is running a lot of tests that nobody's saying what they're doing. Now, what happens over the southeast? The southeast gets this anomalous, persistent, high-pressure dome, and the 2006 hurricane season, not a single hurricane made landfall in the United States. Now, we also had tremendous drought because of the heat associated with this high-pressure dome. The weather talking heads all say, well, it was El Nino. That's what it was. It was El Nino. Well, the next year, there is no El Nino, and yet that high-pressure dome is back. And again, no hurricanes make landfall. We do get, the high-pressure dome is smaller, and we do get torrential rains in Texas. I believe that they're tweaking this thing, trying to get it to the point where it stops the hurricanes, but it doesn't fry out the southeast like it did the first year that they ran it. Now, if you are a beachfront property owner in the Carolinas or Florida, you may think, well, stopping hurricanes, that's a good thing. But if you own a farm in the southeast, or had your property burned down in the wildfires, you don't think it's such a good thing.
Well.
And a close personal friend of mine died because she was a shut-in without air conditioning. So I believe that HARP murdered Ariel Louise, and there's no way I'm going to be able to bring civil action for that.
Well, I think between man's plan in time and God's plan in eternity, there's an infinite quality of difference. And we have people who want to play God. They want to be able to control the weather, and they put a lot of our money into it. And of course, they can actually create hurricanes, can't they, Jerry?
Well, the Russians say they can. The Russians, again, there's elite technologies, and elite technologies insist that they can blow up a big wind whenever you want one. And I think they did it in Malaysia in 78, and I believe they did it again with Gulf War II. You remember Gulf War I, it lasted, 56 hours? When we launched Gulf War II, the Allies assumed we'd be in Baghdad by Wednesday. And what happened? The moment the war launched, suddenly the worst sandstorm in history came up. The strongest winds in 100 years came up and blew sand in the faces of the Allied armies for 3 weeks. I think Saddam Hussein went to his old friend the Russians and said, can you buy me some running time?
Okay. We will never know, though. That's the trouble, because our government would know, of course, whatever was going on there. But since we work very closely with the Russians, of course, we would never want to let the American people know that.
And Saddam Hussein has no problem with doing environmental badness. He has no problem with using the environment to help himself. Leastwise he did before he assumed room temperature, as Rush Limbaugh would put it. During Gulf War I, you may remember the cause of Gulf War I was Saddam Hussein insisted that the Kuwaitis were slant drilling into an Iraqi oil field and stealing Iraqi oil. And he could not get the world community to make the Kuwaitis stop doing it, so he asked us, do you mind if I take care of them? And our ambassador, April Gillespie, said, no, we consider that an internal affair. So he went over and smacked the Kuwaitis. It turned out not to be an internal affair, and we were prevailed upon to prevail upon him and push him back out. And as he left, he, as a good mafioso type businessman might do, he burned all the oil wells that were stealing his oil. The trouble is that 700 oil wells produced this immense cloud of smoke, and this immense cloud of smoke became a serious, one of the world's greatest environmental problems. The meteorologists around the world said, "Oh my goodness, there's going to be hell to pay for this." It will bring on an early monsoon season, and it did. Monsoon season came on several weeks early with one of the strongest monsoons ever seen. Bangladesh is a country where the average altitude of the country is 20 feet, and the monsoon came in with a 40-foot storm surge. There were 2.5 million people in trees, and over 100,000 people died because of Saddam Hussein burning those oil fields.
That's fascinating. I'd never heard that before, Jerry, but certainly it's quite logical because, of course, the particulate matter in the atmosphere can bring about terrible storms and terrible results.
And indeed, that's how cloud seeding, that's how artificial rainmaking got its start in 1880. During the U.S. Civil War, it was noted that great battles were often followed by great rainstorms. And a Civil War general in charge of an artillery battery thought maybe it was the concussion from the explosions of his artillery that was causing it, and patented it. And the very first patent granted for artificial rainmaking was granted in 1880 to a U.S. general. The United States Army has been involved in this literally from day one.
Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. We have time for a couple of calls. If you have a question for Jerry, I don't know anybody who is certainly more well-versed in this field. He's done a tremendous amount of research. His book is excellent, and that's, of course, why we carry it. And in the four-tape set that we're offering on weather modification, why we have one of my interviews there with Jerry, because we think we need to get out his information. Now, what do you think, if there's any relationship to this terrible cold weather we're experiencing here in California and in Los Angeles? And is there simply anything you would say would be totally conjecture, because it's all top secret? Nobody is allowed to tell the common people, but what are your thoughts?
You know, again, Mother Nature gives great credible deniability.
Right.
You can use a weather weapon, and as long as nobody actually sees you using it, yeah, everybody just assumes that it's cranky Mother Nature.
All right, fine. Well, we've got Mark calling from Ohio, so let's go to Mark here in just a moment. Hi, Mark. How are you doing?
Hi.
How do you have a question or comment for us? Incidentally, how are you hearing us? Shortwave or Internet?
I'm using shortwave. I'm listening to you on 49 meter.
All right, fine. Is it coming through pretty well?
Real good over here in Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio.
Okay, fine. Well, tell us, did you have a question or comment for our guest?
I had, you know, I used to do a lot with pirate radio, and there's a radio frequency band that's below ham 10 meter and above the CB band. And we used to listen to that, and they used to call them woodpeckers. And
you're talking about the electromagnetic low-frequency ELF frequency? Is that what you're speaking of?
Yes. Well, the rumor was is that these things were being emanated from the Soviet Union, and even back, as far back as 10, 15 years ago, they were thinking that they were manipulating the weather with these. I was just wondering if he had heard of these. I know that these were popular around 27 megahertz, 27.500, 27.580.
Okay, and, fine. Let's ask Jerry about Jerry, do you know anything about this? I remember it was being talked about maybe 20 years ago.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, in my first book, HARP, The Ultimate Weapon of the Conspiracy, I have a whole chapter on the subject. The chapter is Chapter 3, Electromagnetic Warfare, The Moscow Signal, The Russian Woodpecker, Gwen, and HARP. The Russian woodpecker was very real, and it was called a woodpecker because it was a series of quick taps, tap, 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 then silence, then tap, 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 then silence. It really annoyed ham radio operators for a couple of decades. It went offline. It stopped happening shortly after the Chernobyl nuclear disaster. Apparently, the main part of the system was powered by Chernobyl, and when Chernobyl went down, the system went down.
Okay.
Now, is that similar to over-the-horizon radar? Because they were using very, very similar, on the same frequencies often.
Right. Now, according to the U.S. government, it was an over-the-horizon radar system. The Russians would never admit to what it was. the U.S. government told the world, well, that's an over-the-horizon radar system, and it doesn't work very well. We're not worried about it. And when it stopped broadcasting, the U.S. position was, see, it didn't work very well, so they stopped with it. There are a lot of other theories as to what it was, because it seemed to have a psychotropic side to it. It seemed to come in at a mind level. And one of the big concerns about HARP is that HARP is designed to bathe the Earth in EOF at exactly the same frequency that the human brain works at. So that that's what got my interest in the HARP project. Was I had been studying mind control since 1976 when I met Walter Bowart when he was on his tour for his book Operation Mind Control, which blew the whistle on the CIA's MK Ultra program, which is a very well proven documented piece of badness from the CIA. Walter Bowart, oddly, incidentally, died just a few days ago.
I know, I noticed that. Well, we're out of time there. Mark, thank you so very much for
calling.
Thanks.
God bless you guys.
Hey, thank you. And we'll be back in just a moment here with Mike. Anyway, our guest this evening has been Jerry Smith. His book is Weather Warfare, and also carry his book on HARP, The Ultimate Weapon. So hang on there. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Mike, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay, fine. Do you have a question or comment for
me? Yeah, a question for Jerry. I think he was saying a few minutes ago that HARP could be used to destroy incoming missiles.
Right. That is, as best anybody can tell, that is what it was originally designed to do. That is, the original APTI patents that were developed by Dr. Bernard Eastland and his team is about a system for creating a plasma, which is an electrically charged gas that goes out into space that stops incoming ICBMs. And there is some speculation that HARP may have proven that it can do it simply because it may have brought down the space shuttle Columbia.
Well, that was my question.
Right. The Columbia disaster may have been a case of friendly fire. We know that the HARP antenna array was in use that night. It was up and running at full power, which at that point in time was 960 kilohertz effective radiated power, and it was in full power mode for approximately 90 minutes before the shuttle attempted reentry and continued broadcasting for about another 90 minutes after loss of signal from the orbiter. Now, one of the things we know that, and this is hard data to get, but the U.S. government, particularly DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, admits to four things they've done with HARP, and one of the things that they admitted to was reduction of populations of charged particles in the electron belts or in the radiation belts. That basically what it is that the Earth is surrounded by the magnetic field and the solar wind. Charged radioactive particles coming at us from the sun get caught between the magnetic lines of force and create the Van Allen belts. Now, what HARP has been doing is relieving the particle levels in the Van Allen belts by we send up into the Van Allen belts this plasma which overburdens it and forces it to precipitate out. That is, rain hard radiation back to Earth, which I'm not entirely certain is a good idea. And I know there has been no environmental impact study done on this. And this is being done so that radio signals and hardware can move through the Van Allen belts without damage.
I'm going to have to interrupt you there, Jerry. We'll have to get you back sometime real soon. Thank you so much. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Mike had called in. Mike, we're all done, but I hope that helped
yep.
some of your questions.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye. And Mike had simply asked if the harp had anything to do at all with the bringing down of the one of our returning missiles, one of our returning transport being used to transport Americans back from the space shuttle. I think it was called the Challenger, and Jerry said there are many, many people who think that HARP brought it down. And of course, you have to understand that when our government is quite willing to experiment on hundreds of thousands of our servicemen without their knowledge, if you've ever read the report that came out from the Defense Department during the 1960s, Operation Northwood, where they were actually talking about how we were going to get into a war with Fidel Castro. One of the things, they were going to shoot down the satellite that John Glenn was going up in, and then we'd blame that on Castro. We could use that to justify our war. You have to understand that we're dealing with people who look at the world differently than you and I, who do not value the human life, and certainly in the military, you're quite willing to expend 1,000, 10,000 lives, you know, just so long as it serves political purposes. We know that the invasion of Iwo Jima and Okinawa were unnecessary. We have actually the article out of the Chicago Tribune in August of 1945 pointing out the Japanese have been trying to surrender for 6 months, and we wouldn't let them surrender. And the only thing they asked is that the emperor not be tried as a war criminal, and we didn't try him. But we could have avoided dropping the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We could have avoided the invasion of Iwo Jima and Okinawa and saved American and Japanese lives, but our leaders didn't want to. They were unconcerned about that. And you have to understand, we're dealing with people who look at the world differently than you and I. Well, if you'd like to get the Rockefeller Committee report that has that quotation about how they've experimented on hundreds of thousands of our servicemen, if you'd like, of course, to get other material, we've talked about the things we have, the book on weather warfare on HARP, our four-tape set on weather warfare, our four-tape set on HARP. Give us a call at the 1-800-544-8927. That you can certainly call there and get the suggested price or gift for these products. And we think they're very, very important. You need to understand what this is about if you want to get those pages from Brzezinski's book, Between Two Ages, where he talks about how we'll be able to form storms and droughts. This is written in 1970. Understand, this is not imaginary, it's real, and you need to have this information. But of course, why would anybody want to use this and do harm to our people? Well, very simply, because they look at the world differently than you and I. They are totally contempt for the average individual. They do not believe in sovereignty, they believe in a ruling elite, they believe certainly that we need to have a world government and a new world religion, destroy Christianity, a new world leader. And they are all energized by spiritual forces. And this is the fact that most people do not understand. There really is a spiritual dimension. There are people who are under the control of that spiritual dimension, knowingly or unknowingly. If you have not yet heard my talk on the Forbidden Secret, you need to get it. You need to get our four tape sets on the secret behind the secret. And then, of course, my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. Give us if you remember our telephone number, it's 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Certainly, you can go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. You can pull down our newsletters. Many of them written on the occult, or you can get our little three pamphlet set of each one with five newsletters dealing with the occult hierarchy, and that's the title, The Occult Hierarchy. And if you'd like the pamphlet put out by the Lucius Trust on the work of the spiritual hierarchy, you could request that. We'll send it to you. Understand, we're involved in a spiritual battle being played on a political and ideological battlefield. Our number again, 1-800-544-8927. And please pray for America and pray for revival. because if we don't have a revival, we're going to lose America. And lastly, pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And last night we had a caller. We were talking about Hillary Clinton, and she said that Hillary Clinton was trying to, when she was in the White House, she was trying to conjure up the spirit of Eleanor Roosevelt. And I sort of, I said I hadn't heard that. Of course, thinking about it since then, that's absolutely true. And actually, there was several articles that Jean Houston had been invited to the White House, and it wasn't just Eleanor Roosevelt they were going to channel. They were going to channel Eleanor Roosevelt and Mohandas Gandhi, and of course the First Lady at that time, the Clinton years, had actually had a channeler come in to channel the spirits of Eleanor Roosevelt and Mohandas Gandhi, so they could check with them, and that lady was absolutely right. Well. Oh, right now, of course, our guest is William Grigg, one of my favorite guests, and we're going to be, of course, William at one time was the senior editor of the New American Magazine. He is now, of course, working with the Welch Foundation, and of course is doing extensive writing, and he's written a new book, which we're just hoping and praying we can get our hands on under any circumstances. Well, William Grigg is going to give us his commentary. William, what are we going to talk about tonight?
A number of things I think would be worthwhile to talk about, one of which would be the continuing unveiling of this horrific garrison state, this militarized police state that we're living under, and the relationship between that development and some of the things that are happening in the economy, the prospect of a global economic collapse, and perhaps even at some point we'd have a regional or multi-regional or world war thrown into the mix. But with respect to the Hillary Clinton item that you brought up, I do think it's interesting and worthwhile to recall that she was having those seances, if you will, with Jean Houston. Jean Houston is a charlatan, somebody who was advertising doctoral degrees that she had never earned and a number of other very dubious credentials. But at about the same time she was communing with Jean Houston and whatever numinous beings were conjured up by the two of them, she was also, Hillary Clinton, having sessions in the White House with another woman by the name of Marianne Williamson, who's a big New Age author, whose book at the time was called Illuminata, which I think is a rather provocative title. If I remember correctly, and you might know better than I think Marianne Williamson is involved with this theosophical book and DVD, which is making the rounds, called The Secret. You might have seen that or been exposed to some of the publicity, or had somebody who was raving among your circle of friends was raving about this as some kind of a of a grand and glorious Rosetta Stone to understand reality a little bit better.
No, actually, we have a four-tape set called The Secret Behind the Secret, which goes into Rhonda Byrne's and her efforts, but I didn't recall Marion Williamson was a part of that. Maybe she is. Certainly, Marion Williamson is deeply involved with the cult, but whether she's associated with Rhonda Byrne's, I'm not sure. Just don't recall. But
the basic message of Illuminati seems to me to be, in many ways, intimately in correspondence with this book and DVD, The Secret. I mean, they're basically peddling the same theosophical notions.
Oh, sure.
And of course, Gene Houston was deeply involved in that as well. And it's really interesting that you have somebody now who's within a respectable distance of becoming the first female presidential candidate, nominee, I should say, for the Democrat or any other major party in American history, who is very deeply involved in hardcore occultism. I think that's worth remarking upon here.
Well, I believe that they're in every aspect in almost every government.
Yeah, and no doubt about that, because these are people who worship power, who have a lust to dominate and regulate and manage the lives of other people, and that's certainly not a godly desire, and it's certainly not one that is in any way in harmony with biblical morality or the Christian tradition.
Isn't it interesting that none of the Republicans has brought up this issue? I mean, there's so many things from the time when Hillary was in the White House that could be brought up, certainly her effort to cover bills philandering, and none of that is being brought up at all. And all of the Republicans are just totally ignoring that. They're criticizing the Democrats because they want to increase taxes, but that's about all that they really can say bad about them. Because basically, both the Republican and the president and the Democrat presidential candidates, they all favor the war, but one Republican. Mm-hmm. They all are globalists. They want a one-world government and a one-world religion. They are in favor of increasing spending. The Republicans simply want to increase spending and cut taxes. The Democrats want to increase spending and raise taxes. But that's about the only difference between them.
Yeah, that's true. And when you take a look at the range of acceptable opinion in terms of what the Republicans can say and what the Democrats can say, there is this consensus that we're going to have to remain in Iraq, according to John McCain. And apparently, if the New York Times has its way, the contest this fall will be between Hillary Clinton and John McCain, who are easily the two most thoroughly deracinated, thoroughly establishmentarian candidates of either the Republican or Democrat Party. John McCain was saying that we might be in Iraq for 100 years, and that's perfectly fine by him. Take a look at the Democrats. John Edwards has made certain noises about opposing the war, but that, of course, is a relatively new development in his political history. The same thing with Barack Obama. Barack Obama has got a history of strategically avoiding certain key votes, simply not being there, or being there very late after the issue's been decided. That happened with the most recent vote, if I remember correctly, on an emergency stopgap spending measure to fund the continuation of the war in Iraq. Both he and Hillary Clinton made a point of showing up after the issue had been decided so they could cast a painless but politically useful no vote. And if you take a look at the Republican Party, of course, it speaks for itself. There's only one on either side here who opposes the war, and that's, of course, Representative Ron Paul. If you take a look at Mike Huckabee, he's been saying things by way of trying to criticize the Bush administration on cosmetic terms with respect to its foreign policy. But that, of course, happened after he published an essay under his byline, almost certainly written by somebody in the staff, in Foreign Affairs magazine.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is William Grigg, and he was just pointing out that Mike Huckabee had actually published an article in Foreign Affairs magazine. Now, for those of you who don't know what Foreign Affairs is, it is the theoretical journal of the Council on Foreign Relations, which was organized in 1921 as a front group for a secret society. And that secret society was created in 1891 by Cecil Rhodes. And if you're out there in the listening audience and you find that hard to believe, after all Rush Limbaugh would have told us, let me suggest the book Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, written by Professor Carol Quigley, who is a liberal college professor who had taught at Harvard and at Princeton before he went to Georgetown University, where, of course, he met his his most favorite or most famous student, a man named William Jefferson Clinton. And, of course, it was Professor Quigley who explained to Bill Clinton who really ruled the world, how this system worked, explained to him about the secret society, and explained to him about the Rhodes scholarships created by Cecil Rhodes, who created the secret society that the CFR is a front group for. So we do carry the book, Tragedy and Hope, The History of the World in Our Time. It was suppressed for a number of years, but we even have an interview with Professor Quigley where he tells how his book was suppressed for a number of years, and of course how frustrated he was, not because the book was suppressed, but because he wasn't getting his royalties. I mean, and I've spent many weeks going through Professor Quigley's papers back at Georgetown University, but that's neither here nor there. Let's get to our guest this evening, William Craig, who's been talking certainly about the fact that Mike Huckabee, who's running as a Republican, had actually had an article published in Foreign Affairs magazine, and certainly he has been being helped by members of the Council on Foreign Relations. In fact, when Mike Huckabee was asked about who was advising him in his foreign policy, he used the name Richard Haass.
Exactly.
Now, for those of you who don't know who Richard Haass is, he is the chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations. Go ahead, William.
Yeah, he is the chairman of the CFR, and he has been something of a critic of the Bush administration, albeit from the perspective of a globalist. In other words, he criticizes the Bush administration for being insufficiently dutiful in maintaining the lines of communication and observing the necessary pieties of globalism. I mean, the Bush administration is effectively run by a former president, or former chairman, former president, rather, of the CFR, Richard Cheney. Dick Cheney, the vice president, isn't everything but named the person who's running the Bush administration. And the Bush administration is top-heavy with CFR appointees, as every administration has been since roughly 1933 or so. But in any case, likely because of the personalities involved, there have been some transgressions of the CFR party line, and Richard Haass has been outspoken in criticizing the Bush administration for those sins, not for the manifold sins against the Constitution, against Christian decency, the principles of the just war and so forth, but because they have gone off the reservation on some matters that the CFR considers to be within its bailiwick. And Huckabee's criticism of the Bush administration has followed very faithfully what Richard Haass has been laying out in terms of his talking points to criticize the administration. Now, I find it interesting you have three Republican candidates for president right now who are being urged upon the public, and there are three of them who have had essays published in Foreign Affairs. Rudolph Giuliani, Mitt Romney, forgive me, there are five. Rudolph Giuliani, Mitt Romney, and Mike Huckabee have all published essays in the Foreign Affairs Journal. I believe Mr. McCain, Senator McCain, is a member of the CFR, isn't he?
I'm not sure that, let's see, Thompson was. Yeah, Thompson,
yeah, Thompson
McCain
was.
Thompson and McCain were, and Giuliani is not.
No.
And neither is Romney, so.
No. But if I'm not, I'm pretty sure that the people who surround McCain are very closely aligned with the CFR. If I'm not mistaken, didn't Kissinger have good words to say about McCain today, which would be really ironic given the Vietnam connection here. But the one odd man out, once again, is Ron Paul, who's criticized the CFR and the Trilateral Commission and the Federal Reserve. And if you take a look at the people who are advising Ron Paul, don't construe what I'm about to say as an endorsement on behalf of this program or any other organization for the Ron Paul presidential bid, but I think it's interesting that you have Richard Haass advising Mike Huckabee, the purported Christian conservative, and you take a look at the advisors to Ron Paul, you have people like David Luskin, who's a noted free market economist of a strict and very faithful variety. And then just today, he announced that Ron Paul's campaign announced that Peter Schiff is going to be an economic advisor to the Ron Paul campaign. Now, Peter Schiff was the one who a year ago, and I remember this very well, a year ago was talking about what would be happening, actually it was in late 2006, was talking about what would be happening in the housing market in 2007, and what would be happening with the financial investment, the big investment houses. And then in the late summer of this year, there was a remarkable video that made the rounds on YouTube of a round paddle discussion. I believe it was on Fox News, where he had Ben Stein and a number of other people who are thoroughly established Monetarian market analysts talking about how really people should continue to invest in the big investment houses. And Peter Schiff was on the outs with everybody else on the panel saying you'd be crazy to do so. You know, these people are going to take a huge hit. They're completely insolvent. They're basically involved in fraudulent repackaging of bad loans. And if you do so, you're going to take a big hit. And he was laughed to scorn. This would have been about July of this last year. Just weeks before, of course, we saw how, led by Citigroup and some of the other big investment houses, the entire investment sector started to collapse. So Peter Schiff, who's somebody who's very much a hard money advocate and a remarkably astute and outspoken analyst of the marketplace, and also a very profound and acute critic of the Fed, he's advising the Ron Paul campaign. Well, you've got people like Richard Haass, the CFR, advising Huckabee. So there's a really clear distinction here, and it goes right along the fault line you're talking about with respect to the influence of the Anglo-American establishment and the whole movement that Carol Quigley described in Tragedy and Hope in his book, The Anglo-American Establishment. On the one hand, you've got the one candidate here who still remembers that we do have a document called the Constitution. We have a distinctive American foreign policy rooted in the wisdom of Washington and Jefferson and men of that caliber. And he, of course, remembers a type of conservatism that was rooted in individual liberty and the idea of exalting the Constitution as the standard and, more importantly, as the charter which limits what government can do. You know, he represents that vision of conservatism. Now, on the other hand, he got people who are wholly owned subsidiaries of the Eastern establishment on both sides of the narrow divide that separates the Republican from Democrat parties. And so there are a number of things they won't talk about. They obviously will not, these other candidates, sully the air with talk of the evil influence of the Federal Reserve. They won't talk about the compelling need we have to get out of Iraq and radically to cut the size and expense of government. And they would avoid by all hazards any talk of the eerie and weird and bizarre doings that transpired in the solarium of the White House during the reign of Bill and Hillary Clinton a decade or so ago, or a little bit more than a decade ago, when she was holding seances and trying to conjure up the shade of Eleanor Roosevelt, and she was communing with the likes of Marianne Williamson and then Rabbi Michael Lerner from Tikkun, who's another guy who's got pretty good credentials as a New Age weirdo. So once again, you've got a political cartel here that includes both the Republican and Democrat parties with a few outliers like Ron Paul who are constitutionalists by disposition and principle. And the overriding priorities of this political cartel have to do with perpetuating and enhancing their power over the rest of us. And they're animated by this vicious vision of humanity as being broken up into, on the one hand, the numinous ruling elite, the fortunate few such as themselves, and the hoi polloi, you know, we common men and women who are simply involved in productive lives and want to be left alone to enjoy the fruits of our labors and to develop the talents that God has given us. And what we're seeing right now is that the cost, the financial, social, political costs of the system that these people have created are now starting to have a tangible and frightening impact on the daily lives of Americans. And it is my hope and my prayer, I don't know if it's a forlorn hope, I don't think it's entirely forlorn, that at some point people will listen to the message that Ron Paul and the movement, the movement is much more important than Ron Paul, I hasten to emphasize that because he always does. The movement is putting out with respect to the architects of the disaster that is unfolding before us, and that through concerted action we'll be able to avert the worst that lies ahead of us. Now, we're in for a lot of trouble. There's just simply no avoiding it. We can't see profligacy of the magnitude we've been dealing with from our government that's decades old and probably much deeper and more terrible than even pessimists like you and I would believe. We simply cannot have that type of profligacy and not pay some cost economically and socially for what our government has done. But the worst that confronts us is something that we could possibly avoid if we radically and immediately change course. And if we don't, we're likely to see some things unfolded. I don't think anybody has an adequate imagination to conjure up. We were talking yesterday about what's going on in Zimbabwe, where they have 250,000% inflation, where the government a month ago printed a $750,000 bill, and now just this month they printed a $10 million bill, and that $10 million is roughly two-thirds the cost of the local equivalent of a Big Mac. Now, we could see that kind of thing happen in this country if we don't change course immediately.
And, of course, the best way to destroy a nation is to destroy its currency.
Exactly.
And that is exactly what Alan Greenspan quoted Lenin as saying. And then he went on to say, and not one person in a million will realize what you're doing. And I don't think the average person in America understands that they're intentionally creating inflation. They're lying to us about it. But are you going to believe what they tell you, or are you going to believe your lying eyes next time you go to the grocery store or when you go to the gas station? We have inflation. It's rising, but you ain't seen nothing yet.
Well, of course, the reason that inflation is created is that it gives the few one of their most potent tools to dominate the many. And inflation is the quickest solvent of the middle class. The middle class has always been the enemy of the expansion of government power. And once a nation starts to succumb to the effects of fiat currency and inflation, the middle class always begins to degenerate. America was the first country in history that was created with a middle class. I mean, the term middle class was not in common use, wasn't in use at all in the 18th century. But America was the first country where you had an independent yeoman class or artisan class or property-owning class, what was later referred to derisively as the bourgeoisie. And it was really the first country where a man could be independent and improve his lot and then transmit his improved standard of living to his heirs. And the dream was that every succeeding generation would do a little bit better through the discipline and thrift and industry and vision and deferral of gratification of the generation that came before. Of course, that's something which is completely foreign to our present set of circumstances, where we're told that we have something akin to a patriotic duty to go out and spend every cent that we earn, and then to spend multiples of every cent that we earn through credit to leverage our earnings well beyond our capacity to pay back our debts in order to keep the consumer economy going. And so we're completely mired in materialism and the illusion of prosperity that is bought through the deferral of accountability and through debt, and by imposing this debt through a form, really, quite frankly, of intergenerational socialism. I mean, we're stealing. We're using the government to redistribute wealth yet to be earned by generations way down the line, redistributing that to our present circumstances. I mean, it's almost as if you've got some kind of a time travel equation here, where we're positing that somewhere in the future there's going to be this $57 trillion in wealth yet to be earned by generations yet to be conceived, and we're going to use that to pay for the benefits that are going to be lavished on the baby boomers as they retire, including this obscene Medicaid prescription drug benefit that was rammed down the throats of Congress by the Bush administration in 2003 as a cynical pre-election year ploy to bribe older people who do vote into voting for the Republicans. And this was done as a matter of, like I said, cynical political calculation through strict party line discipline. And if there's one thing that would eventually completely break the American economy, it would be this one act, this one mad act that occurred back in 2003. We've already been warned that within 10 years, well, less than 10 years, in 7 or 8 years, America could use, or the American government could lose its AAA rating, which means that we would no longer be able to borrow, or the interest rates that would be paid by our government would be confiscatory and prohibitive, in the same sense that somebody who's abused his credit can lose his ability to borrow. That's something that may happen to the U.S. government within the next half a decade or so, precisely because of the huge and completely unrealistic deficits and unfunded liabilities that are going to come into maturity. And that's a really good example of intergenerational socialism at work. And once again, as you pointed out, Dr. Stan, we're being told one thing. We're being told not to pay attention to what's going on with our bank accounts, our checking accounts, and our grocery budgets, and our household expenditures. We're being told that inflation is running at a relatively modest rate.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here. Our guest is William Grieg, and he's simply talking about the inflationary spiral that is gripping our country, the fact that, of course, one of the greatest travesties of all time was the Medicare drug bill, which is about $7 trillion of unfunded liability. They didn't come up with any money for it. They just voted it in. Isn't it wonderful? We're going to help the old folks, and then they'll vote for us Republicans. So, but, of course, this was really Ted Kennedy's bill. Ted Kennedy never could get it through. He had to wait till the Republicans got in, and then they could use party loyalty to get the Republican senators and congressmen to vote for something that was immoral, unfunded, and would certainly, as William has said, would eventually bankrupt America. So pick up the story there.
Yeah, and, of course, what's happening with the inflation rate and these other expenses that branch off from the basic living expenses that are carefully factored out of the core inflation index by the government, is that we're seeing the demolition, the decimation first, and then the outright demolition of the middle class, which is the bedrock of a limited government republic, at least by any model that we know from Western history, going back at least to the time of Aristotle. You have to have this independent class of people who can own their own property. And once again, this is an insight that many people don't appreciate. It was certainly not lost on our founders. People who can bear arms in their own defense and in defense of their local communities, that's a very important part of the equation. If you go back and read Machiavelli's discourses, he talks about the old idea that the republic, a republic always rests on the assumption that there is this independent class of people who own their own arms and are invested in the defense of their polis, their city. And that's one of the reasons why the Founding Fathers were so careful to create a constitution and a scheme of government that recognized the paramountcy of the individual right to armed self-defense, which can be exercised collectively through a militia or exercised individually by the armed citizen. I mean, the difference between the citizen and the subject, this is an insight that goes back to Aristotle by way of Machiavelli once again. The difference between the citizen and the subject is that the citizen is somebody who can bear arms in his own defense, and somebody who does not have that right, somebody who's dependent on the government for that protection, is a subject or a slave. And that has to do, once again, with the idea of property and the idea that people who are sovereign and exercise rights which are granted to them by their creator invest certain limited power in government to perform certain functions. And you're describing, once again, the middle-class worldview, and the middle class is being destroyed in real time right now. I'm looking, as I speak with you, Dr. Stan, at a piece from MSN Money entitled Why You Might Never Own a Home. And the first couple of paragraphs of this article talk about a couple from the Bay Area in California, which is one of the most pricey real estate markets in the country. But the two of them together pull in a little less than $100,000 a year, and they're pretty sure that they're never going to be able to own a home. They have one child. You've got, you know, double income, one child. The double income is just about at $100,000 a year. They've run the math. They've taken a look at the direction that the economy is going, that their personal finances are going, and they're not going to be able to own a home on a combined income of $100,000 a year. I'm old enough. I'm turned 45 in a couple of weeks. I'm old enough to remember when my father worked, you know, basically a 9-to-5 job as the sole breadwinner for a family of nine, that is to say, two parents, seven kids, and made, in inflation-adjusted terms, much less than $100,000. But we had a home, a very large and well-appointed home, that was paid for, and two cars and every middle-class amenity we could imagine in the 1970s. It was the 1970s I'm talking about now. And you have here, once again, a double income of $100,000, more or less, one child. These people are hopeless about the prospect of owning a home. There's another snapshot in this article talking about a family from Scottsdale, Arizona. The 29-year-old son of this family, the report says, has many of the trappings of middle-class life, a nice car, an iPod, but home still seems out of reach. It's much harder than it was when we were starting out, says the mother, who considers herself middle class. We paid $16,000 for our first home. You can hardly buy a car for that now.
And that is, of course, a byproduct of inflation.
Yep.
And it has been done intentionally. All the time the government's there to help us, they've been, of course, stealing the value of our money. And, of course, that way you can run up the biggest national debt and you just simply make it disappear through inflation. But inflation also, of course, destroys the holdings of these citizens, destroys their pension funds, the value, the value of any of their savings, the value of their insurance policies. Inflation is a wonderful, wonderful scheme because it allows you to steal from people and not one in a million will understand what you're really doing. We're going to be back here in just a moment with William Greig right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is William Greig, and go right ahead, William.
When we're talking about the assault on the middle class, we have to recognize that it's a full-spectrum campaign. It's not just economic. It's also political, and it's also moral and cultural. In my, I believe it was my fourth book, America's Engineered Decline, I had originally intended to examine in greater detail the moral and cultural and ethical assault on the middle class, but at the advice of the publisher and editor of that book, they took a couple of chapters I'd written about this subject and made appendices out of them. And I consider that to be just as important as the other subjects addressed in the book, which had to do with trade policy and, of course, inflation and economics and also immigration and some of the things that are happening with respect to the, I believe, the deliberate creation of a demographically distinct and demographically re-engineered American population. But the moral element of what's going on here I consider to be very important because, once again, if you don't have a population that understands the necessity of deferring self-gratification, they're going to spend themselves or be seduced into a situation of complete dependency on the people who have the money. And one of the things that I found perfectly alarming that I started to notice about 5 or 6 years ago was the sudden proliferation of, for a lack of a better way of describing them, street corner Shylocks. It used to be that in order to get money really quickly at a potentially extortionate rate of interest, you had to turn to organized crime. And by the 1960s, 1970s, 1980s, there were Shylock laws on the books. Of course, the laws are named after the esurient and amoral character from The Merchant of Venice, who demanded his pound of flesh from Antonio, the titular Merchant of Venice. There were Shylock laws on the books in most states that prevented people from going out and getting loans of the sort that are very common now, where you go to a check-to-cash, cash-and-go, car title loan place, and you take out a revolving credit account, or you take out just a payday loan type of an arrangement where the interest rate can compound with merciless fury over the course of just a few weeks. And if you pay it off, you're paying off a huge chunk of interest. And if you don't pay it off, then the penalties and interest become utterly confiscatory.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in just a moment here with William Greig. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and our guest is William Greig, and he's simply pointing out that now, of course, we're seeing a lot of places where you can borrow money with confiscatory city interest rates. In fact, even your credit cards now, my wife tells me they're running well over 20% interest just on a credit card. And, of course, there are certainly other places where unsuspecting people or desperate people will borrow money at even higher rates perfectly legally. It gives usury a bad name. But before we go on, let's get William get his blog place out, because I'd like you to know how you can get to his blog spot. Go ahead.
I appreciate that. The easiest way to find my blog is to go to the Right Source Online, which is a news page I help to edit. The URL or web address for the Right Source is www.rightsourceonline.com. That's one word, rightsourceonline.com. And if you go to the Right Source Online, you have to scroll down a little bit and look at the left-hand side of the screen. You'll find my picture, and there will be a hyperlink which will take you to my daily blog, which is entitled Pro Libertate. That's a Latin phrase. It means for freedom. And I try to publish a new essay on the Pro Libertate blog between 3 and 5 times a week as my schedule permits. We also have an email journal called Pro Libertate, a new edition of which should be available this next week. It's been on hiatus since May of last year. I simply have not had the time and the means to assemble and edit and produce the email magazine. It's available by email subscription, I should point out, the Pro Libertate email journal, or the Pro Libertate e-journal. And at the top of Right Source Online, the Right Source website, go there today, is a banner ad for my new book, Liberty in Eclipse, The War on Terror and the Rise of the Homeland Security State. It is available for sale through the Right Source website. There is a secure ordering site where you can order the book. I believe the price is $11.95 plus shipping. And if you're interested in buying it in bulk, there's a special bulk rate as well. And pretty soon that book is going to be available through a number of retailers. We're going to make it available through Amazon as soon as we figure out how we're going to work it out, because Amazon, of course, does take a percentage of all the sales. And we're also going to make a quantity available to you, Dr. Stan, so that you can make it available to your listeners.
And we will, of course, be glad to get that. In fact, we have a, you know, a regular site, and then we have an Amazon site, which really does quite well. So,
yeah.
And so as soon as we get they are available, let me know, and we'll be glad to order some.
Sure. Now, we were talking about the moral assault on the middle class, and my perception is that this proliferation of these Shylockian, usurious cash and go, check to cash, payday loan, title loan type operations is a reflection of a real moral liability in the American population right now. That's the inability to practice discipline, to regiment and budget one's funds and one's spending, to defer gratification. And I do think that that's a good example of an opportunistic infection, if you will, in a compromised body politic. And it's by no means a coincidence as well that if you look at any of these communities where we have government-sponsored casino gambling or government-sponsored gambling of any sort, which is a relatively new innovation, that's something that came about, within the last 20 years, I believe, is when they started promoting Indian tribal casino gambling. But you can take a look at concentric rings in the community and know how close you're getting to a casino or other state-sponsored gambling site, because the closer you get, the greater the density of pawn shops and, payday loan-type operations, as people are looking to find some way of either liquidating their personal assets or getting some kind of a quick loan so they can go feed a gambling addiction, a portion of which, of course, is used to enrich a government. I mean, you've got governments of all types that have state-run lotteries that find ways of getting revenue flows out of casinos, and these all, of course, encourage the exact opposite of the yeoman Republican virtues that we have in order to preserve the middle class. You really cannot have a solid middle class that is built on a foundation of instant gratification. And abetting gambling, I believe, is one of the things that has helped to undermine the basic discipline innate to the middle class. And we have an entire economy, really, that is sort of a casino-type gambling enterprise in macrocosm, in the sense that people expect that they'll always be able to be rewarded on the basis of luck, as opposed to skill, as opposed to industry and investment of time and self-improvement. People are convinced that the way to become prosperous is to contract huge debts and then to go out and buy an asset that supposedly will magically continue to appreciate. That's what people were convinced was the right course to take during this housing bubble. I mean, I don't know how many times I run into people, including some very close relatives who really should know better, who told me that the way that you get out of debt is to go out and buy a home, which makes no sense at all. The idea being, I suppose, that this is a magical kind of debt.
Well, I think the idea was that the houses continue going up. I mean,
they
know
weightless.
People. That's right. They know people who bought a home, and you know, the next year it was worth 10% more, and the next year it was worth 30% more or 40% more, and it seems almost like it was too good to be true. And,
yeah.
Of course, the old adage is if it seems to be too good to be true, it is too good to be true.
Exactly. I mean, people believe that somehow we had entered an historical phase of the development of the economy, that for the first time in human experience, a market would become weightless. It would nullify the effect of gravity. It would always rise. That houses would always appreciate, and that you would have a never-ending source of revenue by using your home as an ATM. And I kept telling people, no. A house is a place you live in. It's not an investment in the same sense that a banking account was an investment. I actually had somebody say, a house is like a bank account. You buy it, it appreciates, you take money out, or you simply keep moving from house to house to house. And I thought, no. If you're really part of the middle class, you find a home that will become a home, will become a settled, rooted, established, to use a biblical trifecta there, settled, rooted, and established place in which you can bring up a family and teach your children how to develop and improve and to make appreciate a property, as opposed to becoming some kind of peripatetic speculators involving the most essential assets you should have, which of course is your home. People were very angry that I didn't get involved in the rush to speculative home buying. And one example, just very quickly, I'll share this anecdote with you. I have a friend, actually he's a relative and a friend, a relative on my wife's side of the family, who in 2004, 2005, sold a ranch that he owned outright. And he took the money from that sale and got involved in flipping houses. And he got many people in his extended circle of family and friends involved in that, helping him clean up and paint and refurbish homes, because it was just a magical thing there in Nevada. He'd buy a house, and he'd go out and start mowing the lawn. Somebody would come by and say, well, how much do you want for the house? And they'd be able to flip it right away. I kept telling people, that's the type of behavior that you find at the very end of a housing bubble. People start frantically, manically flipping homes, and that's because people want to make sure that they get in on the last throes of a speculative bubble before it collapses. And it's like a game of musical chairs, where as the music accelerates, you become a little bit more anxious about finding a place to sit before the music stops. I said, at some point, the bubble's going to burst, and he's going to end up with a number of properties on his hands he's not going to be able to sell off. He sold his ranch. Where is he going to live? He's probably going to have to live in one of these homes that he wants to flip. But where's the revenue going to come from? Where's he going to be making his living? He was self-sufficient as a rancher. And now when the bubble pops, where's he going to be left? And, you know, I have other friends who've done the same thing. I've gone into real estate just a year and a half or 2 years ago for the purpose of flipping homes. At least half of those guys are now doing multi-level marketing. And there was another piece on MSM Money that was, I think, reprinted from the Christian Science Monitor this week, talking about this mass exodus now of the people who got into real estate over the last 2 or 3 or 5 years. They were the last in, and now they're the first out. Heavenly knows where they're going to go. But they're going to be joining another exodus of tens of thousands of people who are going to be laid off over the next quarter by the investment houses that fueled the real estate bubble. You know, Citigroup is talking about laying off thousands. Countrywide is going out of business. Of course, they were one of the larger, if not the largest, of the mortgage originators here. And you've got people from across the full spectrum of investment houses who are going to be joining the unemployment line. They're polishing up their resumes right now. They're sending out inquiries. You're going to have real estate salesmen and mortgage writers and all kinds of people who worked in professional occupations for lenders and real estate companies, who are going to be entering the job market again pretty soon. So that will create another title drag on the middle class. These people got in, they thought that they found a professional niche for themselves that would support their families. Most of them are young, you know, late 20s to late 30s, maybe early 40s. If they're in their early 40s, they're going to find that they're not employable now as professionals. you know, their salary needs are going to be too great, and their projected lifespan of employment is going to be too short. So they're not going to be able to find professional jobs, at least not right away, and they probably will find jobs that only offer a fraction of what they're able to earn, just as price inflation starts to eat away at what they earn. So it's a perfectly horrible prospect here, and it's something that was eminently predictable. Indeed, it was predicted by a number of people way long ago. If you take a look at some of the predictions that were made, for instance, the New American magazine, for which I used to write, back in the early years of the 2000s, the early years of this decade, we were predicting a lot of these things that would happen in a tone of, please tell us we're wrong about this, but we're not. We're desperately hoping to be wrong, and we're painfully certain that we're right, and now we're seeing it unfold. And this is happening in the context of a culture that is in free fall, that is perfectly obsessed about the most ephemeral and useless things. And so when we find ourselves in the jaws of a Great Depression, you probably heard or read Robert Stiglitz talk about the fact that we're headed for a 1929-style economic collapse. Stiglitz, of course, is a Keynesian. He gets the analysis right, but the prescription is entirely wrong. But we're headed for that same type of catastrophe with very little, at least by a superficial reading, it would seem. We have very little of the same moral fiber that our fathers and grandfathers had when they were confronted with the Great Depression. But out of the Great Depression, of course, came a new political order that was very useful to the people who engineered that catastrophe. And I suspect that's what's going to happen again.
And, of course, remember also out of that Great Depression of the 30s came the Second World War of the 40s. And, you know, I think that certainly if I didn't know that Joseph Stiglitz, who I have the greatest respect for, has, suggested a depression. But Harry Schultz and James Dimes, two economists I followed for, Schultz for 45 years and Dimes for at least 30 years, and they both talk about a depression. So irrespective of what the administration is telling you, this is just a little temporary blip along the line, and everything's going to be fine. You just put your confidence in us and keep on spending. Everything's going to be all right. I am very, very concerned that we are moving towards really a first of all, probably a period of stagflation, inflation, and stagnant certainly industrial and economic activity, and then a deflation and depression, and heaven help us.
Well, if you take a look at what happened in the last period of pronounced stagflation we had, 1979 through 1982, 1983, one big difference is that that previous era of stagflation took place in an America that had not deindustrialized. We were still in a pretty good place, relatively speaking here, in terms of our ability to produce and to export goods. That's no longer the case. Our industrial sector has been completely strip-mined, and that's the result of our trade policy. The trade policy that we've had is not free trade. The trade policy we have was designed, I believe consciously, way back in the 1940s when Alger Hiss, the same trader who gave us the United Nations Charter, was talking about creating a global trade organization that would be part of the United Nations. Now, of course, we have the World Trade Organization, which is the same entity under a slightly different name, but that's, of course, another bastard offspring of Alger Hiss. And the idea was that we would redistribute the industrial economy that would be put into a situation where the United States would be put through a forced draft deindustrialization, and the redistribution of the means of production and also the wealth would take place, where we would be leveled down to the median represented by the rest of the world. And of course, at that time, a quarter of the world and a third of the world was under the domination of Soviet-centered communism. So bringing us down to the median level of the world at that time meant a severe reduction in our standard of living. And we're seeing that right now, in spite of the glitz and the glamour and the convenience of so many things that really make no ultimate difference in our lives. We're seeing our standard of living brought down. When you have to have both parents work and the children have to be raised by somebody else, be they rented strangers or what's even worse, some affiliate of the government education system, you have a system here that represents a trade-off that no rational person would make, which is you're alienating the upbringing of your children to somebody who is going to raise them as children of the state in order for the two parents to to serve the two omnivorous burdens that every household deals with. The one is their tax burden, and the other, of course, would be their debt burden. And they both originate in the same system. You know, the IRS and the Federal Reserve are two heads of the same hydra. You've got the IRS in charge of regimenting our lives through social engineering, which is what the tax system really is all about. They can inflate the currency. They don't need an income tax. They have the income tax in order to regiment our lives. And then the beast that emits, the head of the beast that emits the inflation is the Federal Reserve. And every single household in this country is a slave to this system. And this is something that I think people are starting to understand. If they actually listen to what Ron Paul and a number of other people who are becoming conspicuous in this movement, I mentioned Richard Kramer in our last program, Stan. Richard Kramer just months ago was begging the Federal Reserve to open the discount window and start to inject liquidity in the markets. He was one of the first people who was sort of an establishmentarian financial commentator and stock picker to sense that something terrible was happening late last summer. And he was begging the Federal Reserve to start injecting liquidity, meaning to run the printing presses in order to stave off the bloodletting and the investment class. And now, after talking with Ron Paul and interviewing him on his program, Richard Kramer is saying, we need to investigate the Federal Reserve. We need to find out who these people are who presume to run our economy from such an Olympian height. But, you know, that's useful. The fact that people are educable is one of the few but resilient sources of hope for me.
Well, I think it really the important thing is to realize how many good people there are here in this country who just do not know. And, of course, that's why I do what I do 5 hours a day. That's why William does what he does. And believe me, his plate is more than full. So it's always a pleasure to have William Grieg with us, and hopefully he'll be here really pretty much on a regular basis here on Friday evenings. He's also with us on Thursday afternoon, or nearly at 3 o'clock. And we'll be back in just a moment here to wrap up today's, or this evening's program with William Grieg.
You know,
you have 3 minutes. Go ahead.
Okay, I do think that we tend to underestimate the number of really decent people there are in this country and the extent to which we're dealing with ignorance rather than viciousness. And ignorance is curable. Viciousness can only be cured through God's grace. Ignorance is something that decent and hardworking people can cure with God's help. And I do think that people across the country, including some from demographic sectors and social cohorts you might not expect, are starting to ask fundamental questions about the way our society has been organized. There was a New York Times story yesterday, a very long one, talking about the mood of the electorate based on this sampling of people in states where there are presidential primaries coming up. And some of these people were saying some very incisive things about the war in Iraq, about our foreign policy, about the cost of our foreign policy, not only in terms of the irreplaceable lives that are lost and the families that are destroyed or left disoriented by the prolonged absence of a father or a mother. God forgive us that we send mothers to war. What does that say about our society? Not only those costs, but also the financial burdens that are being created and the effect that this has on our society. People are starting to ask how it is that election after election, decade after decade, we end up being offered the same narrow choice that is ultimately no choice at all. Basically, the political system allows us to compete between the 40-yard lines on the football field, which means that we can never win. And given the fact that people are asking those questions, and given the fact as well that the media monopoly really is a thing of the past, I mean, the old media cartel is dying. It's been mortally wounded. And it doesn't know. It's a little like the characters from that movie, The Sixth Sense, who don't know that they're dead. And that's a source of optimism too. That's not to say that the behemoth, the media cartel, in its death throes, can't do a lot of damage. It's certainly doing this level best. But there is some fugitive, tenuous cause for optimism here that cataract can be broken, that information can get out, and that one of a family, two of a city, as it says in the book of Jeremiah, you can bring people to understand what's really happening here. And on that basis, I'm cautiously optimistic. But even if I didn't have that basis for hope, I'd still do whatever I can, because I love this country that much. I would like my children, I have five small children, to know something of the country that I experienced as a young man.
Well, we're out of time. Our guest has been William Grigg, and William, I agree with everything he said. God bless you. We'll talk to you again next week.
God bless, and thanks.
Yeah, thank you. And, of course, certainly one of our favorite guests is William Grigg. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly I hope you enjoyed William, and we try to get him on several of our programs every week. One of the most insightful people we have in the country, with a tremendous, tremendous understanding of what's going on. And so basically I wanted to talk about some of our four tape sets. We have one, of course, 911 update, and it simply takes you into what really happened on the morning of September 11th, 2001. 911 update will tell you about the NORAD and why the Air Force did not respond to a hijacking, which ordinarily they would always do. And we simply take you into the background of some of the information that has come to us from Jimmy Walter, a multimillionaire who spent almost $8 million of his own money in New York City, running full-page ads in the New York Times and running television spots to try to convince the people of New York, and he did convince probably half of them that they had not been told the truth. But Jimmy Walters has been forced to flee the country and is living in hiding in Europe because he had the courage to point out that we have not been told the truth about what happened on September 11th. We have a four-tape set on Aleister Crowley, Aleister Crowley and his friends, and of course Aleister Crowley was a Satanist, the leading Satanist of the United States during the 20th century. We have a four-tape set on the American Armageddon, talking about the coming war, the apostate church, and that goes into the background of what is happening to so many of our churches in the United States today that have given up the traditional approaches or trying to entertain people to get them in. It has to do with the church growth movement. That's the apostate church. A four-tape set on the Aquarian conspiracy. And that, of course, is my interviews with Constance Cumby, who's written extensively on the New Age, and, of course, the Luciferian movement behind the New Age. That's the Aquarian Conspiracy four-tape set. A fascinating four-tape set, Where is the Ark of the Covenant? My interviews with Ron Wyatt, who claims that he'd found the Ark of the Covenant and Noah's Ark and the place where the children of Israel really crossed the Red Sea. And, of course, then two other interviews with people who worked very close with Ron Wyatt. That is, Where is the Ark of the Covenant? Four tape set on the attack on America, and, of course, who was responsible for the attack on the World Trade Center. And, of course, then, of course, we have a four tape set on the battle in Seattle. Do you remember when they had the World Trade Organization and a lot of the bankers meeting up in Seattle, and there were massive demonstrations, and most people don't understand that those demonstrations were carefully rehearsed, and there was no need for this. The mayor was working in conjunction with the rioters, and it was keeping the police from intervening until things were totally out of hand, and part of downtown Seattle was actually burned. But the Battle of Seattle, an excellent four-tape set, showing how you get this pressure from above and pressure from below, and then, of course, you and I are in between. Bioterrorism, four-tape set on bioterrorism, four-tape set on black helicopters. Are there really black helicopters? Yes. You'll actually hear an interview with a woman who's a friend of ours. They sent a black helicopter to her home to intimidate her and her family. And, of course, other interviews with other people who've seen the black helicopters. They're used to frighten and intimidate people. That is four-tape set on the secret of the Bohemian Grove. The Bohemian Grove, and that's, of course, up here just north of where we are, where all of the elitists get together. They have a big owl, 40-foot owl that they worship. And, of course, this is worship of Moloch. And incidentally, we have a great a DVD on the Bohemian Grove as well, put out by Alex Jones, and you'll actually see the ceremonies that are taken there. He's done a great job on that. So you can get either the four-tape set or the DVD on the Bohemian Grove, or I suggest you get them both together. a four tapes out on the changing church. That's the church growth movement. Chemtrails, fact or fiction, and chemtrails update. And we're just about out of time. Please, of course, pray for America. Pray for Radio Liberty. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to know anything more about any four tape sets, give us a call.
Your turn.